All right, this is our very last meeting in this series. And what we are going to talk about is we're going to introduce and discuss the last astrological element, the aspects. Now, even though this is only going to be one talk on all of the aspects, the amount of time given it is not an indication of the importance, because the aspects are without a doubt the most important element in applied astrology. In fact, if you're given a horoscope, somebody you've never seen before, and you have 5 minutes to look at that horoscope and say something that will impress the person, blow their mind or something like that, the way you can do that easiest is to look at the strongest positive aspect and the strongest negative aspect and just talk about them, and you will always impress the person. It's not something like a standard sun sign kind of thing. You're actually talking about the dynamics of the psyche, and that makes an impression, because that's not something that's visible, and that's not something that's very... it's not a stock thing. Now, this series of talks is meant not to be really technical. It's meant to be more pedestrian, and it's more for anyone who has a light general interest. It's not meant to get into all of the technical things of applied astrology. And for that reason, we're only being very light about the aspects. Now, I do have an entire course that takes about a year or two that talks only about the aspects. It's called The Aspects in Spiritual Astrology, and it's a very, very good course, but I don't know if I'm ever going to offer it again, because I don't know how much interest there is. No, it's a different altogether. It has all kinds of things in it. Now, the aspects in astrology are different than all of the other elements of astrology. They're not obvious when you look at a chart, unless you look at one of those charts that has too many lines in it and too many colors that complicate things and make it more difficult for you to concentrate because there are so many distractions. How do you like that for an opinionated statement? One must determine the number of degrees along the ecliptic to tell whether two planets are in aspect with each other. There are other ways that the aspects are different from the other elements, and that is that it's impossible to have all of the aspects between all of the planets. It's even rare for somebody to have one of each kind of aspect. Every horoscope has the same 12 signs in it, and every horoscope has the same 12 houses, and every horoscope has the same planets, but the aspects are different from horoscope to horoscope. The aspects are really momentary configurations in ongoing movements of the solar system. The planets are always moving, and sometimes they form an aspect with each other, and the lines of force between them accomplish something in the cosmos, and then they pass on. So what we're looking at is something dynamic that we look at in a very static way. The signs in houses are always static. The signs represent fields of attitude that maybe over many thousands of years changed their quality as the consciousness of the different beings of the cosmos evolved. And the houses, as different kinds of opportunities come into evolution, they change too, but they change even more slowly. Planets move, but they return to their positions, and they return with predictable regularity. The aspects, on the other hand, are relatively evanescent from phenomena, even though some aspects might hang on for 40 years, like that sextile of Pluto to Neptune that probably everybody in this room has in their chart, except me. I'm the young one in the class, and I... Now, before we introduce the aspects and aspects in general, let's briefly review everything we've done. It's always important to do that. We begin speaking about signs. And we say that signs represent fields of attitude. They are each sign has a quality that's all of its own. It's complex. But it's a quality all of its own. Each sign parallels every other sign, and each one has something that every other sign has, but each one has a different emphasis and a different chromatic point of view. So each sign is like a whole mythos all in itself. And so there are parallel feelings. Houses have slightly greater applied significance in astrology than signs. And as we've said before, the houses represent fields of mundane opportunities. Opportunities that we have along our lines of development. They relate to the earth at the place of birth, and they're drawn from the place of birth, and they're not relative to the solar system as the signs are, so they're much more local. They have forms and structures which are like the social structures or the life structures through which things are brought about, things in culture, things in daily life, all of civilization. They too, like the signs, are very complex ideas, but they are complex ideas that have more to do with focus or condensation of qualities into more definite experiences. The function of the houses is more like the function of a maze or a railroad switching yard or something like that, where you see which line of opportunity is most opportune or most likely or the best one for the person to choose. The houses represent receptacles. Without the houses, the fields of the signs would still be there, but they would have nothing to contain them to make them available for use in the mundane physical world. You would have no canvas on which to paint the colors. Canvas with its shape and its texture and such is what the houses are like. Now, planets are definite astrological agencies. They are something that do the focusing. They are what pours the grape juice into the glass or the lemonade or whatever, coffee or whatever you're drinking. So the planets are active, moving doers. And each of the planets is a qualitative specialist. Each one has a character and a specific function that is it all of its, all on its own. And each planet is an epitome. Each one is such a specialist that it is as if it were one thing altogether. It isn't exactly one thing altogether, but it seems that way. The planets are dynamic focusing agents. They take the sign qualities and they focus them to a given time at a given place so that something gets done. Planets are not fields. They're definite foci, and they concretize things. And the important thing for applied astrology is that planets work both directly and indirectly. They work directly by the sign and house that they are in, as well as the house that they rule by the sign of their rulership being on the cusp. So planets, as the focal agency, you can see, are more important. As we progress along, we get to ever more important things, and it seems almost logarithmically the way the importance increases from the signs to the houses to the planets and to the aspect. The important thing that we've talked about quite a bit when we talked about the planets is that the planets are people. All the people in our lives represent planets, and all the planets in our horoscope represent people. And it gives us a way to understand what we can't see with our physical eye, or to interpret what we do see with our physical eye but do not necessarily know or understand. So now we come to the aspects. And the aspects are like spiritual tools. They are used by the planets to effect various kinds of work, whether it's psychological work or whether it's actually even something like physical work. Planets represent definite action. They're specialized beings, and the aspects between planets represent the modes of the planets applying their energies or applying their qualities. Aspects are specialized in their very design, in their very pointed modes of activity. Aspects are constantly present, like the other elements are not constantly present like all the other elements. They come and go. Now, each of the aspects is like a tool, and all of the tools are important if you have certain things to do. I happen to like to garden, and you use a shovel for one thing, and a trowel for another, or a rake for yet another thing. And so each tool is designed to accomplish a specific kind of task. And each aspect is like that. It defines a specific kind of activity of consciousness in the soul. In fact, it even goes so far as to indicate a specific kind of physical tool or activity. So we have shovels and hoes and clippers and rakes and all of those kinds of things. Now, the tools that we have, if we put them in human consciousness, we have a specific name for them. We call them talents. We say that a person has a talent for doing something. And so what the aspects represent then is the talents that a person has. Again, we want to impress this fact that with the aspects, we're dealing with the most important part of applied astrology. All right, we're looking at the most basic and the most simple elements of astrology, and we're looking in that at the strongest and most significant part this evening. Let's give a definition of an aspect. It's kind of a dull, boring definition, as definitions tend to be. The aspects are geometric or trigonometric relationships between astrological significators that have mathematical, philosophical, scientific, and psychological significance. Since you all wrote that down so quickly, I'll repeat it. Aspects are geometrical or trigonometrical relationships between astrological significators that have mathematical, philosophical, scientific, philosophical, or real physical significance. Now, there are, in most forms of astrology, two types of aspectation. There is longitudinal aspectation, which takes place on the zodiac, on the ecliptic. And the other type is declinational aspectation. And this board represents, with the double green in the center representing the celestial equator, represents declinational divisions north or south of the celestial equator. Now, for the sake of simplicity, we're going to look only at the longitudinal aspects, because the longitudinal aspects are most important to psychological understanding. The declinational aspects, which are various different types of parallels, are at least as significant and as strong, and sometimes even stronger, but they usually apply to physical conditions or psychological conditions that have built into the physical nature. There are other systems of aspects, but you know, they're pretty far off for us to even mention their existence. Now, there are many different kinds of longitudinal aspects. Any two planets anywhere on the zodiac affect each other. It's just that some relationships between two planets are more significant. Some have very little significance. The people who grasp at straws often grasp at low significant aspects because there's something weird. There is that temptation with astrology to do something weird rather than do something that is important or something that is fundamental and basic to someone's life. We're going to discuss only these five aspects, and they are called the Ptolemaic aspects, after Claudius Ptolemy, who is sort of the grandfather of Western astrology. And what we're saying is, if two planets are in the same degree of the zodiac, plus or minus a tolerance orb, they are in conjunction. If two planets are 60 degrees apart, plus or minus a orb, they are said to be sextile. I guess we could put the name up here and do something like that. Square trine so if they're 90 degrees apart, they are square to each other. If they're 120 degrees apart, they are trine to each other, and if they're opposite each other in the zodiac, they are in opposition. Now, very often, especially among careless astrologers, aspects are called good or bad. That kind of nomenclature is not the best, because then if you happen to have a number of what are called bad aspects, you start thinking that you are bad. And some people go even further and call them good and evil aspects. In the last analysis, we are all gods. We are all gods in the making. And ultimately, our basic nature is good. Right now, we have a little bit of trouble, and we do introduce discord and make things harder to do. But ultimately, we are good people working to be better and to make the cosmos a better place. So as things stand right now, good and evil does describe some things. A better way to look at the benefic versus the malefic aspects is whether the accomplishment of the action between the planets and the aspects will be easier to do or whether it will be harder to do. Sometimes the malefics seem to be so difficult that it seems impossible. there is a talent either way. And sometimes what are called benefic aspects can be used to malefic ends. And sometimes malefic aspects are used to benefic ends. Like, for example, Mozart introduced a lot of things into music that are based on the square. And for if you're learning beginning music, you know, playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star or something like that, some of those chords sound discordant. They sound ugly and harsh. But when they're used properly in a much more refined and complicated system of music, those dissonances turn out to be very beautiful. They have a kind of beauty that you can't get with the simple things. So do not take anything for granted about whether something is good or bad, or whether it's going to mean suffering, or whether it's going to be all pleasant, because anything can be used any way. I have a friend who was born that had almost all trines in his horoscope, and he died in his 50s, and he had all of his teeth out of his mouth by the time he was in his 30s, because he got involved with the flower children and all the drugs of the flower children, and was sleeping in doorsteps and all of that sort of things. The strength of astrological aspects varies according to the exactness of the geometric relationship. That is to say, if two planets have zero orb, if they're exactly together, which is called partile, by the way, if there's a partile conjunction, it's much stronger than if they're 5 degrees apart, which is a pretty loose orb. So not only are the aspects the strongest part of astrology, but the aspects that are the closest to exact or perfect are much, much stronger than those that are not so strong or not so exact. Now, the way an aspect forms, let's just take the conjunction as a simple thing. Let's just say that Jupiter is in Scorpio as it now is. And let's say it's at 18 degrees. And suppose the moon is coming along. As the moon moves up to 18 degrees, when it gets to 12 degrees, it is said to be within orb. The standard orb that we use for beginning things is 6 degrees. And it keeps going up, and this is called applying. When it gets past, this is partile. When it gets past the partile aspect, it starts separating, and the influence is off by 24 degrees of Scorpio. Now, when an aspect is applying, it has a different quality than when it's separating. When an aspect is applying, there is a buildup of tension. Whereas when there is a separating aspect, there is a relaxation of tension. Now, they've actually done studies on this, on octogenarians, people who live to be very old. And they find the only thing astrologically common in octogenarians that is statistically relevant is that they have a higher number of separating aspects in applying. Which means they have a more relaxing kind of life, and they have a sense of relief. Even if there are problematic situations, there is a sense of relief. So the maximum orb that I recommend would be 6 degrees. Now, this is something that you have to learn by experience. Various different astrologers throughout history have used all kinds of different orbs. I met one chap once that wouldn't deal with anything with a anything greater than a 3-degree orb. And this is a very brilliant man. Now, if you have 3-degree orbs only, what you say is bound to be accurate. And what you say is bound to be significant. But if you use only 3-degree orbs and there is a true applicability to a wider orb, you're going to miss something. On the other hand, if you open things up and have 10-degree orbs, you're not going to miss anything. But what you say may not be highly relevant. It may be vague, and it may be more in your mind than it is in reality. There's a lot of that goes on with astrology. And it's an interesting psychological study to study other astrologers, because you see how they talk themselves into believing that something is there, and they will try to convince you. They'll treat you as though you're blind if you don't see what they're seeing. With, you know, there's a big difference between reading something out of something and reading something into something. And that's something a lot of astrologers are prone to do, because they have their own pet theories. So only experience can tell you this. Sometimes a person will have a personality trait that you cannot find with any of the standard things, and then you have to go looking around. And one of the things you can look around for are minor aspects or different size orbs or harmonies or things like that. So all of astrology, if you really start doing a lot of practice of astrology, it requires a lot of judgment, good sound judgment. And you have to look around. Now, intuition probably the most important thing, but if your intuition is correct, astrology should provide a means that you can check out your intuition. Those are the other two things beside good sound judgment. They are intuition and observation. All right, to get back to the definition, we say they have mathematical significance. If you study anything from simple geometry to trigonometry or analytic geometry, or start going up the line, you'll find that all of the astrological aspects that we're talking about are special cases. Like, for example, special cases in the equality of sine and cosine or things like that. Philosophically, they have significance in that they represent universal creative ideas. Platonistic or Pythagorean ideas, and that's the way we're going to look at them in a few minutes. They have psychological significance because we respond to the environment psychologically. And they have done studies with radio reception. I think I may have mentioned this in a past talk. They've done studies with radio reception, and what are considered benefic aspects are when people are supposed to be more peaceful and harmonious and cheery and all of that. They have found out that radio reception is better when there are a lot of benefic aspects in the air rather than malefic aspects. So there is something real in the physical sense, and there's a psychological reality. They represent lines of force. Shifting lines of force. I'm sure we've all seen it in family dynamics or in power structures on an athletic team or something like that. The dynamic changes, and this is what coaches thrive on, is they try to get the right person into the game, because that person is going to change the whole dynamic, and they call it the chemistry. And with the aspects, it's like that. As you see aspects applying and separating, or a new aspect coming into activity, you can see the dynamic of the cosmos change in a given situation. And they represent patterns of inner activity. things may not show outward light. I just received two emails today from a friend who was going through a period of great trial and was trying not to be negative about life, but felt that if you had to be negative with anybody, it might just as well be me because I could understand it. And so I performed the function of being the psychological punching bag. So she didn't punch at me directly, but she just threw all of those things my way. So these are methods of accomplishment. So now let's start looking at each of the aspects. We'll just go right in this order. No, we won't go right in that order. We're going to count. We're going to count from 1 to 6. Only we're going to omit 5. Pythagoreans would be very upset about it. It's way too far afield. We'll start with the conjunction. It's when two planets are in the same degree of the zodiac. Now, if two planets are in the same degree of the zodiac, one will not necessarily be on top of the other because they may have different declinations. And you can look, you know, you look in ephemeris and say, wow, it says the moon is conjoined Jupiter tonight. And you'll look off there and it looks like they're a degree or so apart. But when they get exactly at the true north-south line, they'll be on the same line at the same time, but one will still be north or south of the other, and that is because they're different in declination. If you have, when they are have the same declination and the same conjunction, that's a very powerful thing. In such a case, you wouldn't even know Jupiter was there unless you were clairvoyant or unless you knew it mathematically, because such a thing is called occultation in astronomy, because Jupiter is occulted or it is hidden behind the sun. So the mathematical nature of the conjunction represents a consciousness of congruency. If you have congruent triangles and you lay them one on top of another, you don't know that one is under the other. That is, two things are brought into the same identity. So it is an aspect of locating something. It is pointing something. It is bringing something, something to your consciousness by having it reinforced by two things sharing the same identity space. Now, if you look at the conjunction philosophically or psychologically, it represents unity or an attempt at unity. Even if two planets are very different in nature from each other, say something like Saturn and Uranus, which represent the very old and the very new, if they are in conjunction, there is an attempt to get them to work together. That is, to pass the baton from the old to the new. Now, psychologically, when you have somebody who has conjunction consciousness, there's a tendency to simplify. You try to get everything to work together toward one point, toward one end. Now, that point might be a beginning, and it might be an ending. Usually, when it's applying, it is an ending. But when it is separating, it is a new beginning of a new cycle between the two planets. So when two planets are brought together, you have two lights focusing on the same place. And that means there is concentration. And if there's concentration between two very different things, it's easier to identify which one is which. If you have the very old right next to the very new, you can see that the very old is old. And there is a tendency of the conjunction to want to produce indifferentiability so that everything is brought together as one. It seeks one, seeks unity. Now, when there is that kind of a concentrated focus, it usually results in some kind of breakthrough. So the consciousness, the psychological or philosophical consciousness of the conjunction, is the consciousness of making a breakthrough. Now materially, that point on which things turn is the fulcrum. It's a turning point. It is a datum. It's a specification. It's something that is brought to a point, and the significance of that point determines its function in the whole of a structure or of a construction. When there's that kind of concentration and two things are brought into unity, there's a quality of fusion. So the conjunction always represents a fusion. Now, if you think of tools, the punch, or a needle, or a nail, or a pin, or anything like that is a conjunction tool. If you look at it in a different way, if you look at it as concentrated purification, then everything is brought to a one state. That kind of concentration is like all of the light from all around is focused down to one point, as you do with a lens. And when things are fused together, the conjunction is an aspect of melding. The talent of the conjunction is concentration. When there is a really strong concentration, especially like for example, if you have Saturn conjoined to the Sun, you have somebody who's extremely mentally concentrated. It's hard to break their concentration. And it comes to one thing only, and it simplifies things by elimination. And it eliminates by ignoring everything that isn't what it is trying to do. So you can see in the conjunction there is something of a quality of specialization. The mode of activity is segregation. What is in the concentration and what isn't. Another way of mode of activity is ostensiveness, pointing. Now, some kinds of structures in consciousness that come out of the conjunction are juxtaposition. When something is side by side, you can see the meaning. Disintegration, when two different things are broken down to form one. Also, it is a structure of narrowing. The conjunction in method is very steadfast. That's because it's single-minded. It's so single-minded that if the Sun is in a really strong conjunction and it dominates everything else in the chart, you have somebody who has a monomania. The rulers, there are two rulers. The Sun. Oops, I should bring this over. The Sun and Saturn. Each one indicates a different kind of one or unity. Saturn, obviously, is when everything is brought to a point. It's a pointed kind of unity or one. The Sun is when everything is all one. It's a spiritual kind of unity. Just a second, I'll turn the camera off. I'm going to open the door up. It's a little hot in here. All right. Well, he can edit. Yes. Yes. All right. Now let's look at the opposition. The conjunction is when there is one point on the circle. The opposition is when there are two points on the circle, two points that are opposite of each other. If you have a circle and you have one point on that circle, its relationship into the center is such that it produces a line of force that goes across the center. And when it goes across the center, you have the opposition. And it is basically a line. The conjunction and the opposition are unique aspects in that there is no geometrical figure for them. They're each lines. One is a radius to one point, and one is a diameter to two points across the center. So the mathematics of the opposition is linear. There's a tendency to delineate. But that tendency to delineate in a straight line fashion in a cosmos that is at least as curvilinear as it is rectilinear results in going off on a tangent. So the opposition, it can be tangential. Obviously, the speaker has a lot of oppositions because quite a bit of these talks has been tangential. But there is something diametric about this. If the conjunction represents a breakthrough that happens at the end of one cycle and at the beginning of a next, the opposition is a turnaround. When something that may have started here goes so far, and on a circle it can only go so far, and then it turns around and it's coming back home after that. And so there is oppositions represent turnarounds. I'm one of those people that has to eat my words many times in life because of all the oppositions. And it happens quite frequently. I will have one position, and then I'll study something more deeply, and I'll have a bigger outlook, and then I'll have the opposite. And it keeps on going that way. And it's a very mental aspect. We look at the opposition philosophically and psychologically, it represents internal differentiation. That is, it divides things. It differentiates one thing from another. That is both a blessing and a bane if you have an opposition. You can separate one thing and say how it's different from another, but if you're constantly looking at separative differences, it's not a very healthy or pleasant psychological or social condition to be in. And anytime you differentiate, you multiply. So there is something about the quality of the opposition that produces a differentiation, but the differentiation doesn't necessarily answer things. It's like a silhouette. You've seen those silhouettes where you look at it and you look at it one way and it looks like a vase or a candlestick. If you look at it another way, it's two faces facing each other. That's the kind of silhouette. And the opposition, since it is extremist and tries to pull in two very opposite directions, it is very, very paradoxical. It's a kind of consciousness that's difficult to deal with. Materially, it represents any kind of pole or any kind of line, an electric line or a pipe or anything like that. It represents roads, anything that is an extensor. If you go stay on the line, but if you get off the line, it represents a boundary. That's where that internal differentiation comes about. It produces a boundary. Everything is on this side of the line or on that side of the line. Or you're with this planet or you're with that planet. It's a very, it's an unstable kind of thing because it's always pulling back and forth. Now, if one works with this really well, one of the good qualities of it is that one ends up with a balanced approach. Not a symmetric approach, not necessarily a stable approach, but something that's balanced within an ongoing dynamic. It's something that is fair because it's constantly looking at things from both sides of the issue, or two sides of the issue in case there are more. It's always weighing things. And somebody with a lot of oppositions is somebody who has a lot of alternatives. And there are also a lot of deferred decisions. I'll be able to come back to this later on when things tilt the other direction. It's a quality of vacillation, sometimes hard to make up the mind, extremely hard if there are a strong opposition or a number of oppositions to somebody who has extremely hard time making up a mind. Sometimes it is a making up of the mind that isn't a very pleasant one. It's the aspect of people who are two-timers or turncoats or people like that. The mode that it uses to accomplish things is polarization. If you can polarize somebody on one side of an issue or another, you can accomplish things. And it's a separation, not between one against everything, but it's a separation, the most basic, between two things. Now, it's a mode of activity that if you can't be everywhere at the same time, if you oscillate back and forth, you give the effect of being in both places at the same time. It's like the scanning principle, or in music, it's like a compound curve. With a simple instrument, you can play, you know, like on a guitar, you can play a line here and then jump up and do a line here and then come back here and play. And it sounds like you're playing a duet because you rapidly switch back and forth between two melodic lines. And it's that kind of oscillatory quality. It's, of course, extremism. If you carry something to two absurd extremities, you have a pretty good idea of what each of those two qualities is like. It works by doing ups and downs. And it's a one-on-one aspect, and it almost always has some kind of rivalry or duality in it, one pitted against another. It does tend to segment things. It does tend to divide, which is what two means. It contrasts things, and it compares things. The conjunction also compares, but not in the same way. The two rulers are, the number one ruler is Mercury, the very, very polar planet. And the other is the silhouette maker herself, the moon. Mercury is quite variable, very linear, can speed between poles very quickly. The moon is very moody and paradoxical. If you have, let's go back to the Sun and Saturn for a second. If you have the Sun and Saturn together in a conjunction, you have the universal and the specific hitting on one thing, they're focused on one point. And that is usually a very high pressure aspect. It is a damned if you do and a damned if you don't aspect. And it's usually an aspect, the Saturn-Sun afflictions, all of them, but especially the conjunction, are an indication of somebody who didn't put forth their utmost in a past life. And now they got all of this pressure on me, it's sometimes almost paralyzing pressure, but you've got to do something. And so what results is, with the Sun conjoined Saturn, is a high degree of sincerity and a high degree of conscience. When you have the moon opposite Mercury, you have somebody who's really indecisive, somebody who can't make up their mind at all. There's constantly a vacillation between cunning and concrete thinking. It's a very no body to soul. I don't know how to say that. How do you anchor the soul as everything's up in the air and fluttering about? So there's no focus of spirit there to do much deciding. So Mercury and the Moon are extremely indecisive. All right, let's move on to the trine. Mathematically, if you are trying to locate any given point, you cannot locate that point except in relation to two other points. For example, in navigation, it's called the principle of triangulation. So it means the location in space in a way that is anchored, whereas the opposition goes back and forth and the conjunction is stuck in one place and it lives unto itself alone with no relationship to the rest of the whole. Those are very different kinds of consciousness. This is a location, and it's a location that you can know. It's perfect. It's the simplest number of lines or points. When you have a trine, you have 3 points on a circle. And 3 points are, or 3 straight lines are the least number of lines to produce a geometric figure where there is an inside and an outside. This is in n dimensions. The least number of lines is 3. So there is something about the opposition that represents perfected objectification. It is something that it produces a simple object. And it's the simplest kind of sufficiency. It's sufficient unto itself. And when you have somebody with a trine consciousness, with strong trines or a lot of trines, there's somebody that don't need somebody from outside. It seems like they can manufacture everything from within their own being. There's, you know, if you have opposition, you have thesis and antithesis. If you add that third point and everything is perfectly balanced, then you have synthesis. And with synthesis, you make something. Just like you make that triangle, you have accomplished something. Now, we see these things physically all the time. Mountains, and especially volcanic cones, are based on this. If we listen to music, the simplest chords that are a moment of feeling or that are a moment of sound are trine. They're triadic harmonics. And there are color, the color minima, whether you're in beams of light or whether you are in pigments of color. 3 is the least that you can use to make all of the possible colors. Now, if you think about this as a tool, it is a tool of gradation. It's an inclined plane. You can use it as a wedge, or you can use it as an axe to gradually split something up. Or you can use it as a staircase. You know, if you want to go from one floor to another, you can't jump straight up. But by the ease of application, if you go on an angle, you accomplish that. Anything that involves a blade or anything of that nature, even though the angle on the blade is a much smaller angle than you have on the triangle, the principle is what is involved in the triangle. In fact, they even say if somebody is more spiritually proficient, for example, a jazz musician will say to another jazz musician, "You can't cut that." He's saying that you don't have enough perfection to do better than that. This is when something has been perfected enough so that it's easy to do. But sometimes in that ease, you can jump way ahead of other people and they can't keep up with you, so it's not always a pleasant thing. It is simplicity. If you can do it in the simplest way possible, that is what the trine represents. It also represents perfection. The trine in all cultures has always been the emblem of manifest spirit. So the trine is considered a spiritual aspect. A trine represents creativity. That's that same sufficiency again. Within itself, it can create because it is sufficient. The spirit is like that. It creates everything within itself. It doesn't need anything outside of it. It, like the conjunction, is purifying because most trines stay within one element. They have all three members of that element. Suppose it's air. If there's a grand trine between Gemini, Libra, and Aquarius, there is a purification and a completion of air. This is elemental completion. Every other geometric figure is a completion also, but this is the most elemental. So it is purposeful. It is projective. It is like fire. In patterns or in structures, it minimalizes things. It is something that you can have the maximum tolerance of stress. If you produce a tetrahedron, on any point of that tetrahedron, you can have the maximal amount of stress. They do it in physical chemistry. That's what they use to fabricate diamonds. They have tetrahedral presses. They're based on equilateral triangles like this. Four presses all coming together in a tetrahedron into one area. And they maximize the stress and they press the carbon into a diamond. It's conflict minimalization. Because the opposition obviously meant something like argument, this way, that way, this way, that way. But if you bring in a third person, and that third person comes in, then you have a pleasant interaction. It isn't just this way or that way. When it accomplishes things, it does things by pyramidal accomplishment. Little by little, it builds up. It also works by attribution, by abstraction. It's a spiritual creation and not a physical. It's fulfillment in the simplest and the most perfect completion. If a person has a lot of trines in their horoscope, they're going to feel fulfilled. All right. Primary ruler of the trine, I presume I have all of the chalk on the stand. The primary ruler of the trine is Venus. The secondary is Jupiter. In this case, the primary ruler is all the more important because Venus is soul perfecting. And love is very objective. And there's that ease and that relaxation that comes from universalization of Jupiter. And so the whole quality of the trine is pretty pleasant and affable. All right, let's... Whee! Master of astrology stumbles over his cards and falls on the floor. Now we're up to 4 points. Jerry will have some idea about it all at another time. He'll probably have me with a reel over there with a spring trigger in it that feeds it out and takes it back in. Then I daren't fast, or the thing will just pull me right off the center of things. All right, the square. 90 degrees plus or minus orb. The square, mathematically, is an intersection. Because if you take and go across those 4 points, well, sort of, you have the cross in the center. So astrologically speaking, the square and the cross are the same thing. We've talked about this several times during this course. We said that this is the principle of quadrature. If something is at right angles to the center of the Earth, the structure is likely to be sound because it isn't going to pull one way or the other. And so there's that kind of stability that's involved in it. We've talked about it as the right-hand rule, where all fields, including the fields that are the matter, like of this blackboard, are a result of the right-hand rule. It is the closest and shortest distance when you take a normal. That is to say, if you're trying to locate, you have a point anywhere, and the closest place of that point to any given line is on the normal, which is at right angles to it. That's all right. When they're watching on, they miss something. We have to deprive them one way or another. So the whole idea of things being orthogonal or even Cartesian, all of the arches that are produced on bridges are based ultimately on the principle of the square. It's a square plus b square equals c square, and then you go through all the different variations of that and the whole quadratic equation and all those things. All right. Because everything is on the square, philosophically, the square is associated with justice. In our language, there are a lot of things that point to it. We say that a person does things with rectitude, which is another right angle quality. We say, is this person on the square? And all the systems of logic, going way back to Aristotle, are based on the square of logic. So there is something right, or there is something correct, or there is something fundamentally sound with the principle of the square. But mind you, when somebody is fundamentally right, they're not always easy to get along with. They insist on that right, and in terms of character qualities, it's not a pleasant thing always. And sometimes, in the dense physical world, those squares become cubes. That is, they become building blocks. But they become blocks that can be impedimental. So the square represents that kind of impediment, that kind of blocking, as well as the stuff or the elements for construction. The square is the aspect of construction. Therefore, if you see a square between two planets, you see that somebody is constructing some new character quality. It's a materializing aspect, again, by that right-hand rule. And it is something that completes things in a strange way, seasoning. Like when you think of seasoning in terms of food, you don't get the idea. But if you have seasoned wood, or if you have a seasoned veteran who have seen all four phases of the building process of the year, you have someone who is seasoned. In terms of tools, it is the square itself, so dear to the masons. They use that for squaring, correcting everything. I never forget the first time I squared a block of wood in shop class. It kept getting smaller and smaller. I eventually ended up with a square piece of wood, but it was an awfully small one. The plumb bob, which determines that right angle, is a square tool. Anything that is a standard, you know, where they have the standard gram, or they have the standard unit of area or volume or anything like that. That kind of standard is a, you know, when you're put to the test, obviously we're talking about an aspect that has to do with tests and trials and things of that nature. everything in human consciousness is measured by the square. We do not, even though the triangle is a simpler geometric figure, we have no way in our consciousness or in the consciousness of the cosmos for conceiving area or volume without the square. We even measure the area of a triangle. It's 1/2 the base times the height squared. And Newton, if you take any shape of any kind whatsoever and you want to measure its area, how do you do it in the integral calculus? You turn it all into little squares and you integrate them all together, and that's the way you measure things, is through the square. Now, since on the zodiac, if you have a square, you have all four elements on the corners of that square. So there is something about the square that is combative. What do we call such combat? We call mixing it up. This is why it's very hard to accomplish things with squares, either simple squares or grand squares. It's very hard to accomplish something because you're dealing with opposite polarity elements, things that don't work well together. And when you're dealing with a square, you're trying to get things that don't work well together to do that very thing, to work together. With the opposition, the polarity is such that you're always dealing with either both signs are positive or both signs are negative. And that's not quite as difficult as when you have this thing of mixing it up or combating or in things like that. So it represents internal obstructions. Right within the process of trying to build something in character, in that very process, there's a difficulty built right in. The method of the square is let's have it out. Let's see who's the better person or who's the stronger person or something like that. And there are really square people. I worked with a man once that worked in a testing lab where people would bring in products and materials, and they'd give it to this man. He was mostly self-taught. And he would test things, and he would find what their weaknesses were. And boy, that man was really persnickety. He was a square, you know, in every sense of the word. So it represents trial. The two rulers are, the main ruler is Mars, and the secondary ruler is Saturn. Mars represents drive and desire and action and building. Saturn represents control or caution. And so when you have a square between Saturn and Mars, you have one of the most frustrating combinations that you can get. You can bring some mechanical control out of it, but there's always friction. There's always combat. Because if you think about it, what do we call the boxing ring? We call it the squared circle, where you determine the strength of the spirit of a man by whether he can win a combat. Last figure that we're going to deal with is the sextile. That is 6 points. And if you put the center in, you have the Star of David, the symbol of the macrocosm. This is the first of all of the aspects that is two geometric figures put together. Just as three is the first and simplest geometric figure, the sextile is the simplest compound figure. So it's like you might call the sextile a double trine. And it indicates things that if something is sextile to something else, A would be here and B would be here. If they're sextile to each other, they are each on a different triangle. Jerry gets a big charge out of it. He'll probably choke me with the cord after a while. So what we're talking about is something that is reflective or something that is obtuse. The figure of the sextile in when the, all six points are figured out is very fundamental. If you take balls all of the same diameter on a plane, the most that you can get on a plane are six around the seventh. And so that is a principle of the simplest way to occupy plane space. The way it works when you're working between the involutionary and the evolutionary triangle is that each is a reflection of the other. So what you're dealing with the sextile is a deflection or a reflection. And so you have some kind of inverse fulfillment teaching rather than creating yourself. If you expand your consciousness to someone else or reflect it to someone else, you have an indirect accomplishment. In consciousness, the sextile represents diversification. If you stay within that one simple triangle, you're always within one element. But if you have an ability and you compound that ability to or reflect it to something else, you have diversification. Good example in history is Richard Wagner was a supreme composer. But when he designed his own opera house, he studied acoustics. And therefore, he reflected or he diversified from one field into another. This is why it is so macrocosmic. If it's a simple trine, it's a simple perfection, and it stays that simple perfection. But if you have the macrocosmic sextile, it is something that universalizes and carries it all over. Now, this figure is a structurally strong thing. I don't know how to say it. But, for example, if you try, you know, if you put up verticals, I don't know, are verticals are the joists, right? All right, you put up the joists. And then you're putting board, what? Studs. The studs. You put the studs up. If you put the planking along that runs at right angles to the studs, if you put it at right angles, it isn't as strong as if you put it at a trine angle. But if you use the double the trine angle, you have a really strong force, a strong structure in space. This is why the sextile or the hexagon is used by bees, because they can keep building the hive bigger and bigger and bigger, and it doesn't collapse on itself. Or this is why you have the minimum amount of material with the maximum amount of strength, like the beehiving in the wing of an airplane. It's because you have that great strength from two trine angles put together, efficiently used in space. So it's a gentle space filler that is very strong. Now the tools that are associated with the sextile are the mirror. The opposition mirrors also, but the opposition, when the mirror reflects back at you, everything is reversed. But the kind of mirror that you reflect on an angle is you get a different view of things. The prism, which takes light and expands it into many components. And a perfect example of looking at things from all kinds of different points of view is a kaleidoscope. That's a sextile kind of consciousness. Gears are often based on the sextile also. As a talent, it is enlargement, making things bigger. It's also expansion. It's expansion of interest. And it's more comprehensive. The understanding of the trine is perfective. The understanding of the sextile is comprehensive. It gets a big picture. Now, not everything from that big picture is pleasant. Unfortunately, people have the desire to misuse comprehensive things or to misuse things that are powerful. And the sextile is sometimes considered a malefic aspect. And it is associated with things like hexing. You know, like in Germany, if somebody has stabbing pains the way I did last fall, they call that a Hexenschuss. It's a pain that comes from somebody giving you a hex.
Question.
Yes?
So if it can be malefic, why is it benefic on the board?
Because it's usually benefic. And when it's malefic, you have to take in all kinds of other things, whether there are other aspects in where it is occurring, where it is occurring in terms of oblique ascension in the ecliptic. Sometimes squares act as sextiles, and sometimes sextiles act as squares, depending on the oblique ascension, which I think has to do with apparent incidence of light and not actual incidence of light. It's a little bit of a complicated thing to go into. So, its mode of activity is it refers. It doesn't have to do everything itself. It doesn't have to be perfect in itself. It is expansive in such a way that it has a consciousness of referral. And it is a consciousness of universalization. And it is extra-disciplinary. It doesn't stay within that one way of looking at things. It's open. Of all the aspects that we've looked at, the sextile is the most open, because when you open yourself up to another figure, you open yourself up to the whole cosmos. Its structure is for supporting. And with the double triangle, it is reinforcing. You can reinforce with 90 degrees and 45 degrees and 135 degrees too, but they're never quite as strong as the reinforcing that comes from the sesamogesal system. Complementation and differentiation mixed together. The opposition can sometimes supplement, but the sextile complements. It gives something from the side that you need. It's also the ability to take something from the microcosm and generalize it to the macrocosm, or vice versa. So it is an aspect of generalization. Even more than the trine, it is not as creatively synthetic, but it is generally synthetic in that it brings all kinds of different things together. And usually, it represents some kind of preliminary activity or some complementary activity at the end. The rulers, the primary ruler, where are we here, is obviously Jupiter. The secondary rulers are likely Uranus or Mercury, though that would be a very controversial issue. Therefore, if you have a conjunction, if you have a sextile between Jupiter and Mercury Uranus, you have universalization in an instant. It is taking one instance and automatically being able to universalize or synthesize from that one thing. You have a sudden expansion or a very rapid expansion. And so the whole quality of the sextile of these three planets would be a charged atmosphere. And that is as much as we have for this year. Now you realize that